talk about the Einstein action, which is, or in other words, a variational principle for general relativity. So the first bit is going to be fairly straightforward. We're going to look at how we deal with Lagrangians and integration on manifolds. We'll find what our Einstein action is. And then we'll start sort of poking at it a little bit and thinking about some curious things to do with the Einstein action, which will kind of lead us on to being a bit more sophisticated about actions and thinking about the, you know, the importance of the boundary of a manifold, and in particular whether that boundary can itself also have dynamics. So that's the aim for today. So why would we want to do an action? Well, whenever we're doing high energy physics, we usually sort of work from Lagrangians or actions. So I think almost all of the theories that we consider can be written down in terms of a variational principle. So in that sense, we want to try and develop an action for gravity. But also, if we want to do anything that's sort of vaguely quantum mechanical with gravity, that also means that we'd like to at least try to develop an action and see just, you know, how far we can go with that approach. So we've got to ask ourselves two questions here. Number one, how do we work in curved space, integrating on a curved manifold? And number two, what is our gravitational action? Okay, so that's what we've got to do. So the first thing is to say, well, how do we integrate on the manifold? So what we might want to do is to take a little box of our manifold, d4x, because this is our sort of coordinate volume. But then we immediately see that that's not a good volume to use because it changes under a coordinate transformation. It gets a determinant of the coordinate transformation, so that's like the Jacobian for our coordinate transformation. So you can think in brackets remember that alternating symbol versus the sort of covariant epsilon tensor. So thinking of it in that terms, we can see that, or we sort of suspect that if we have a metric and we add a root det g, then that might actually solve the problem. Now, I'm just going to point out that I could try to be careful and always put in minus signs when a Lorentzian determinant is being taken, but I know I'll forget. So I'm just flagging now that if you see root g, it's understood that it's root of the modulus of that g. So this gives us Uh, a sort of consistent measure to integrate on our manifold. And it's really just the physical volume of a little coordinate box. So as per usual, if we're thinking about how to define something meaningful on the manifold, usually we want to define covariant things. And for us, that typically involves something that is physically sensible. So here, we're integrating over the whole manifold. So thinking of something that's an actual volume element is the right thing to do. So now, just before starting to think about actions, let's just ask, how does that change under a variation? So in order to find out how root g varies, if we vary g, we're going to use this identity that the determinant of a matrix is the exponential of the trace of the log of the matrix. So that tells us that delta det m is det m delta of trace log m. And that's trace of m inverse delta m, or minus trace of m delta m inverse. So that's what we're going to use when we do our variational principle. So in terms of doing an actual variation, I'd like to sort of do that via example. So I'm going to go to something extremely familiar, the simplest thing we can do in field theory, which is a massless scalar field. So if the scalar field is massless, the only contribution to the Lagrangian is just going to be the kinetic term. That's just a half grad phi squared. But of course, on a curved manifold, this is what grad phi squared is. It has a hidden factor of G inverse in it. So here, if we're going to do a variational principle, we're obviously going to vary with respect to phi, which is our physical scalar field. But if I'm thinking more about gravity, and gravity being a sort of manifestation of curvature of a space-time manifold, then the physical quantity or physical observable of gravity is the space-time metric. Because how do we know we're in a gravitational field? We measure distances. How do we know we're not accelerating, but that we're actually in some gravitational field? We look at tidal forces. How do we detect tidal forces? We look for relative displacement, squeezing, so relative accelerations. We can only do that if we have a measure of distance. So this is our gravitational observable. So when I vary my action for a massless scalar, I want to vary it not just with respect to phi, but also with respect to g. So we're going to do this step first, and then we'll think about the rest of the gravitational action. Okay, So let me think about what happens when I vary this action. So the first thing I see is if I vary with respect to phi, I've got two d phi pieces. So I cancel off that half. And I have a grad phi dotted with a grad of delta phi. Then I've obviously got a half d phi d phi delta g inverse. And finally, I have to vary root det g. So varying root det g gives me a factor of another factor of a half from the square root. And then, of course, varying det g gives me minus trace of g delta g inverse. So this gives me minus a quarter d phi squared g mu nu delta g mu nu. So that's the full variation of my scalar field action, accounting for variations of the scalar field as well as variations of the metric.
Did you vary for that square root?
Yes. So when I vary the square root, that gives me the extra factor of a half. I was saying, so that's why it's a quarter. And then you can convince yourself. So. So I can integrate by parts the first term, and I get a boundary term, which is delta phi grad n phi. But of course, by the variational principle, we always take delta phi equals to zero. So I've got a boundary term. Which are set to zero. So these are the usual rules of the game of doing a variational principle. So if I ask what is the functional derivative of the action with respect to phi, I've just got this first term. Which is in fact just the D'Alembertian acting on phi. So that's what you would expect for your phi equation of motion. So this is your wave equation for phi, but just remember that the D'Alembertian now is the curved space wave operator. So it's not just dt squared minus dx squared minus dy squared minus dz squared. So that's the first bit, and that's worked exactly like you would expect. You've got the same equation of motion. The only slight difference here is you're living in curved space and not flat space. And then the other piece which is the variation with respect to g is actually something that you probably recognize, which is the energy momentum of the field. So given that G, I claimed, was our gravitational observable, if I'm varying my action, matter action, with respect to the metric, and I get the energy momentum tensor, then that's a pretty good sign. So in essence, this is going to be what defines our energy momentum tensor. It's going to be the variation of a matter action with respect to the metric, gives the geometric energy momentum tensor. So this has given us a source term, for gravity. So now we would like to think about what is our actual gravitational action, what's going to give us the kinetic part, the gravity action. So obviously we're looking for a scalar because we want to do an integral. And we need it to have some sort of, to depend on some sort of derivatives of g. But now we end up being sort of departing from our field theory analogy, because if we just take first derivatives of g, which is what we would normally think, you know, kinetic term is the d phi squared or, you know, dg squared, that's not going to work, because we need to have something that is a geometric invariant, and the dg appears in our connection, and we know our connection is not actually a tensor. It's not a geometric invariant. So it's something that depends on our choice of coordinates. So, you know, that's a little bit disturbing, but at least we do have a scalar that does contain derivatives of g, although they're second derivatives. So we've spent our time talking about manifolds, talking about curvature, deriving curvature, and we found a curvature scalar, which is the Ricci scalar. So that's the obvious thing to try. The only thing to notice is it's a little bit odd, because instead of having dg squared, if we use r, we've actually got d squared g. You know, just crudely speaking, where d is just some derivative. So that's the only thing that's a little strange.
Does that give any conceptual problem?
Sorry?
Does that give any conceptual
problem? Well, that's what we're going to see. There's obviously something to it, otherwise I wouldn't have flagged it.
But this is the reason why the graviton should be a two-spin particle, right? That it is a two-form metric.
Well, it's not a two-form because it's symmetric. It's just a covariant tensor. So in this case, this is just, it's just the way the geometry works in general. So, and it does actually have, it is going to be, by the end of the lecture, hopefully, I'll have got to the point where the implications of using R rather than something that looks like dg squared come in. Now, obviously, I'm being schematic here, okay? So I'm just, I don't want to use D because I mean something specific by D. So that's just a point to note. We will come back to it, but you know, let's just plow forwards and see what happens. At least we do have some scalar that has some derivatives of G. So let's look at our Ricci scalar. So when I vary the Ricci scalar, The Ricci scalar is the Ricci tensor contracted with the inverse metric. So the second variation there already has a delta G inverse in it, and I'm going to get a minus a half G mu nu R from varying root G. So I've already got my Einstein tensor. So this is actually looking very promising. The only thing I need to worry about is whether something comes along to mess things up for us, hidden in this delta R mu nu. So that's what I have to compute. So I need to find this variation of the Riemann tensor, and I'm going to use a coordinate basis and the expression for Riemann in terms of the connection symbols. But I'm going to do this using normal coordinates. And these are a very useful sort of set of coordinates, or it's a useful trick when you're calculating variations. So in normal coordinates, from a physical perspective, normal coordinates are just a local inertial frame. So in other words, at a point P, our connection vanishes. So we've fixed our coordinates such that the space-time looks flat. I mean, it isn't flat because the Riemann curvature is not zero, but the connection is zero at P. So in other words, G mu nu comma lambda is zero at P. But second derivatives of G are not zero. So we can always choose our connection to be zero at P, but not necessarily in an open neighborhood around P. So gamma might be zero, but D gamma is not. So here, that means in normal coordinates, the partial derivative and the covariant derivative of an object are the same, as long as you're only taking a single derivative. So what it means is we go to normal coordinates, we ignore all the gamma terms, but we don't ignore d gamma terms, and we look at our variation. We change our partial derivatives to covariant derivatives because we're in normal coordinates. And as long as what we end up with is geometric, then we have a geometric expression. Yeah, we've computed it in a normal coordinate system, but if it's covariant, that doesn't matter because what we've learned is that if we have something that is a geometric quantity, it doesn't matter what coordinate system we compute it in. So we'll see that explicitly. So that's the method. So let's have a look at that in terms of our varying our Riemann. So because Riemann is essentially d gamma plus gamma wedge gamma, I don't need to worry about the gamma wedge gamma terms because one of the gammas will always be zero in the normal coordinate system. So I only keep the first two terms in my expression for the components of the Riemann. So here, delta r mu nu is delta of connection, the derivative of delta connection, minus the anti-symmetrized part. So, because I'm in normal coordinates, I can change my comma partial derivative to a semicolon, a covariant derivative. But now I look at that expression and I think, well, okay, maybe my connection is not invariant, my connection isn't a tensor, but the difference between two connections is a tensor. So now this is a covariant expression. So without any work at all, I've already found the first step towards varying Ricci. This actually has a name because someone bothered to lay claim to it. And this is called a Palatini lemma. So my final step is simply to re-express the variation in the connection in terms of the metric. So if I use normal coordinates, I'm taking what I have to remember is that it's the derivative of delta gamma we need for RAB. So the first derivatives of the metric are zero in normal coordinates, but second derivatives are not. So I need to, if I take delta G, when I do that, I'm basically, you know, the only bit that contributes is the first derivative of delta G here. So when I put that in, and the other thing, of course, I need to do is normal coordinates, comma goes to semicolon, and I also want to take to go from being delta G to delta G inverse. Something went astray in my notes here. I think this is what I mean. Okay, so what have I done here? I've Recall that what I need are the derivatives of my delta gamma. So I pick out the pieces that are going to remain. Anytime I just end up with a first derivative of a metric, that's not going to contribute because I'm in normal coordinates. So this is all that I actually need from delta gamma. I then turn my comma to a semicolon. So I've now got a covariant derivative. This is now a covariant expression, so I can use it. And then the only other thing I've done between here and here is instead of having delta g, I've flipped to delta g inverse, and so I've got a relative minus sign. So this is now the variation of the Ricci tensor. Now you may have seen something, yep?
In the top one, why didn't you vary the inverse metric?
Because then that's just going to give me first derivatives of the metric, which vanish in normal coordinates. That's right, but I'm taking delta g. I'm just looking at differences in Ricci. So I don't want anything that's just going to give me Ricci. So I'm looking for differences in Ricci. So I just need differences in derivatives of the metric. So you may have actually seen something like this because I know you did quite a bit on gravitational waves, which is great and interesting. So you probably saw something like this when you were looking for the equations of motion of ripples on a space-time. So you would have been linearizing Einstein's equations. You may have just done it in a vacuum background. So in other words, you know, that does end up simplifying things a little bit because there's no additional sort of Riemann or Ricci terms. But you've probably seen something like this anyway. And so you'll have seen that, you know, if we were looking at this from a perspective of just propagating fluctuations in our geometry, then we would have a wave operator, which is our sort of free field equation, you know, spin 2 wave operator. And these other pieces here would just reduce to something that you could set to zero via a gauge transformation. So you it might look slightly different here because we're dealing with this on a general background, but this also will give you, this is sort of so this crops up when we do gravitational perturbation theory.
In that last expression, the last term, what does the g without indices mean?
It's a trace. As I said, something's gone askew in my notes. The indices didn't match up, so that must be what it is. Yeah, looking at the expression. So this is what crops up in perturbation theory.
And what do you mean by g minus 1?
Inverse.
But this is down, or it's not inverse?
You can have g inverse, and then you can raise, and this is delta g. So it's delta g. So it's a particular tensor. You can either have delta g or delta of g inverse. So when we're doing our variational principle, here I haven't really stressed that this is indeed delta of g inverse, but you can see it from over here where I was writing the variation of that m, and you had trace of m inverse delta m, or you can have the trace of m delta of m inverse. So we don't usually write g inverse when we're doing this. It's kind of understood that we're varying with respect to the inverse metric. But I wanted to make it explicit over there because the indices are flying all over the place. They're going up, they're going down, you know. So that's the only unusual thing, David. I think when we're doing it normally, we're not so careful to put the G inverse on it because we kind of know in the back of our mind at one point we're doing the variation with respect to the metric and then we flip to the variation with respect to the inverse. I just wanted to make it explicit because I was going from one to the other. And it's not obvious from where the indices are. Where were we? So I go back. Another question. That's all right, actually. I think I've got plenty of time.
Isn't the trade of arithmetic a geometric quantity?
Well, if you just got the metric and you try and trace it, then you're going to end up with one index up and one index down. So the answer is the dimensionality of the space-time. Well, but this is the variation of G. It's delta G. It's not G itself. So delta G, the trace of delta G as a quantity, as a tensor, is not zero. So now I'm going to just state this is what delta R is. I'm now going to drop these delta G inverses because typically when we're working with this, we don't actually put it in. But I'm just flagging it here. This delta G here is the variation of the inverse metric. So this gives us the overall variation of our Ricci scalar. We've got the bit that we want, and then we've got two extra pieces. But notice these two extra pieces are both exact derivatives. So it's a total derivative, this extra term. So our concern that somehow delta R mu nu might mess up the Einstein equations actually turns out to be unfounded because the extra pieces are just a total derivative. So if I now take my variation, I can integrate the second bit by parts. So what I end up with is my Einstein tensor. Plus the boundary term. So if I now combine, so strictly speaking, my Einstein tensor is my Einstein action I'm sorry for writing down there. I don't know if you can see it. So to get my, if I now look across at what I got with the scalar, my scalar action, if I varied with respect to the inverse metric for the scalar action, I got a half times the scalar energy momentum tensor. So if I want to add this a gravitational action, I have to multiply by minus 1 over 16 pi g so that I get the Einstein equation. I think I'll rewrite it because it's too small there and tucked away in an invisible corner. So we choose a prefactor of minus 1 over 16 pi g so that when we vary the combined matter and gravitational actions together with respect to the inverse metric, we get our Einstein equations. So that's our Einstein-Hilbert action. So it looks like we've done what we set out to do, which is to get a gravitational action so that we can consistently, at the Lagrangian level, combine gravity with any sort of matter source. There's just one slightly odd thing that's happened on the way, and that is we've ended up with this boundary term. So normally, when we have a boundary term, which probably hiding behind that blackboard. Normally, when we do a variational principle, we say delta phi is zero on the boundary. So here, for our variational principle with respect to g, we would want to say delta g was zero on the boundary. But this boundary term does not have delta g in it. It has derivatives, normal derivatives of delta g. So it depends on what's happening actually in the manifold itself. So we can ignore it, but it leaves us with a slightly uncomfortable feeling because we're actually going somewhat beyond the usual remit of a variational principle. So that's our only concern, and the reason is that we used a scalar that was second derivatives of the metric, not the normal type of kinetic term. So I want to just sort of finish off today with a line of thought which is going to motivate going back to this gravitational action and correcting for this boundary term. So let's just also think a little bit more about our gravitational action. And let's think again about our black hole. Suppose we wanted to sort of imagine that we're going to at least do some sort of naive type of quantum gravity, where we take our gravitational field and we try and do some sort of path integral for our gravitational field. So let's say we'll go to Euclidean space, so things have a definite sign, and we'll take a path integral over Euclidean geometries, so e to the minus action, and so that would be dominated by saddle points, which are stationary points of the gravitational action, which would be solutions of the Einstein field equation. So that would be, you know, can we do something like that? So if we try to do something like that, then what I'm going to argue is that we hit a little bit of a problem if we just take the Einstein-Hilbert action on its own. Okay. So I'm going to do this again by example. So let me just ask, to what extent is taking a Euclidean approach sensible? So let me take the Schwarzschild solution and turn it into a Euclidean solution. So in other words, I want to have plus, 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 plus for my signature. This is still a solution to the Euclidean Einstein equations because to some extent, when we take a metric and we calculate its curvature, it actually is surprisingly independent of our signature when we go down to equations of motion. So the only time that you have to be careful is if you have cross terms between t and other coordinates. But in something like this, with the block diagonal metric, you can take your Lorentzian black hole solution and simply wick rotate in time and get a Euclidean solution. So in this case, this metric is now not defined. For r less than 2gm, because these two terms would become negative, and we can't really change our signature. So whereas the Lorentzian metric, we were perfectly happy to swap the roles of t and r as we went over the event horizon, for the Euclidean metric, we've got to stop. We've got to stop at 2gm. So let's see if we can do that in a consistent way.
Do you mean that the black hole cannot exist in Euclidean?
No, I'm saying it just has to stop at 2gm. So that's, I'm just pointing out we can't take this metric for r less than 2gm. So let me look at what happens as I go to 2GM. I'm going to focus in on the TR part of the metric. So as I go to 2GM, this is what my metric looks like. And if I look at this dr squared piece, I've got dr squared over r minus 2GM. Now that looks like if I take, you know, this, I can integrate up my coordinate r by taking a square root. It looks like d of root of r minus 2GM. So I'm going to try defining a new coordinate rho such that rho squared is proportional to r minus 2gm. If I do this, then my d rho is looks like lambda over 2 rho dr. And so so my dr squared has the right sort of behavior. So what all I've done here is I've rewritten my radial coordinate in terms of another radial coordinate, rho, that looks like the square root of r minus 2gm. So now, if I choose my constant lambda to be 8gm, then that rho is simply the proper distance away from r equals 2gm. So I choose my lambda so that rho is just a proper distance, and then if I look at my metric, I've got d rho squared, and if I look at the d tau squared piece, I can replace r minus 2gm by rho squared on 8gm. So rewriting what I've got is something that looks like the origin of polar coordinates, provided I make tau an angular coordinate. And I've got to have it as an angular coordinate with a range 2 pi. So tau over 4gm has to be an angular coordinate with range 2 pi. And that means my tau coordinate has to have a periodicity of 8 pi gm. So the fact that Euclidean time is periodic is actually a sign that we are in a finite temperature space. So when people want to do field theory at finite temperature, they wick rotate to Euclidean time and periodically identify Euclidean time with a periodicity beta, which is 1 over the temperature. So reinstating all the various constants that I've conveniently and traditionally set to 1, you end up with the conclusion, at least from this very simple calculation, that what you're actually dealing with, if you try and put field theory on this geometric background, is something that's at some finite temperature beta, which is, temperature 1 over beta, in other words, inversely proportional to the mass. So this is a very convenient way of calculating the Hawking temperature of whatever system you've got, in this case, the Schwarzschild black hole. Realize this microphone's kind of somehow hiding.
One question. Should we suspect something?
You should be very suspicious, yes.
Yeah, something strange is going on because of the fact that we have lost part of
the space time.
Cover space time. If we could do, found a finite Hawking temperature in crucial coordinates.
Well, you can certainly, when Hawking did his original calculation, sure, he did it in Lorentzian space, but not in full crustals, because, of course, you do it assuming you've had actual gravitational collapse. So you have, to the past, you've got a scry minus, and so that's your in vacuum. And to the future, you have a scry plus and a horizon, so you've split, your vacuum now into... you've split your basis of states into a basis on scry plus the bit that's going over the horizon. And so it's the mismatch between that out vacuum and the in vacuum that tells you you've got thermal radiation. But, here, in a sense, from a physical perspective, us as outside observers, we can't see inside the black hole. So who's to say this is such a strange thing? It's kind of more thinking about, the nature of complexifying solutions, that, the fact that you sort of, on the one sense, you can go across, and in the other sense, you sort of hit more of a wall. It's not actually a wall in the sense that what I should say is, let me just sketch the geometry of the TR. What it looks like is this. which we call a cigar, in the sense that we have at r goes to infinity, r d tau squared is 1, so this is g tau tau equals 1, so we have a little circle, and that's where we would say that looks exactly like flat space at a finite temperature. But here is 2gm, and our TR geometry smooths off completely. So geometrically, our space-time is topologically, sorry, topologically, not geometrically, r squared cross S2, because, of course, there's a two-sphere over each of these points. So that's our Euclidean geometry. And I just want to finish with a sort of thought or a question, which is that if this picture is correct, then I might expect to be able to take a partition function that looks something like a trace over states of e to the minus beta h. So this is your sort of standard type of partition function at a finite temperature. And this relates to a trace of e to the minus Euclidean action. Now I'm being schematic here because I'm just finishing off with a thought. So IE would be Euclidean action. But for Schwarzschild, this is zero because Schwarzschild is a solution to the Einstein equations. So it has vanishing Ricci curvature. So that's a bit odd. We've got a whole load of interesting solutions to our Einstein equations with flat Ricci curvature, but non-flat Riemann curvature. And yet they're all giving zero action. So this is a sort of hint that maybe the Einstein-Hilbert action is not quite complete, because it's, if we try and perform any sort of, you know, if we're trying to do even the most naive sort of quantum gravity, and indeed there is some validity to this approach, then we sort of almost fall flat on our faces before we even start, because we can't distinguish between black holes at different masses and different temperatures. So what we're going to see is that, of course, the clue, as I've kind of set it up, you know, by emphasizing all these points throughout, is in this boundary term. The fact that we are doing going beyond what we should when we do a variational principle, we have set grad n of delta g to zero and not just delta g. And that's a bit more than we should be doing. So when Gary Gibbons and Stephen Hawking went back to doing black hole thermodynamics in the 70s, and this was before they knew, you know, we knew just how badly things went wrong with quantum gravity, so they were trying to do this Euclidean gravity, they kind of got to this point and saw, oops, you know, this isn't working. But being smart guys, they noticed that this term here had been ignored along the way. And so they went back and thought, well, what if we are more careful with boundary and we think about boundary terms, perhaps a dynamical boundary? And then what they did was they found a term that was a boundary term, which we now call the Gibbons-Hawking term, that we add to the Einstein-Hilbert action that takes care of this problem and indeed gives us non-zero answers for the full gravitational action. So that's what we're going to look at tomorrow.